Hi everybody, thanks for attending the talk about NoSQL databases. Actually the title is a bit wrong, even if it's shown there. So it's more about NoSQL databases in general and saving data in databases, relational and NoSQL in general. I'll give some overview of how NoSQL databases are different to relational databases, look at a few examples. It's impossible to cover everything in this 45 to 60 minute talk, so I may skip over a few slides. I also got a replacement notebook here, so I hope everything goes well, but I think I'll try. So the talk actually is about NoSQL and relational databases and how they are different. And I just introduced myself. So I'm Jan. I'm a developer, software developer. I work at a company in Cologne, Trigens GmbH. I work on a database, RangoDB, which is a NoSQL document database as well. And I like databases in general, so I used a lot of databases in the past. I still use databases, I work on databases, so I do a lot with that, and I talk about that a lot, so I might get chatty. If it's too much, just yell. One recurring topic in this talk will be how to save an object from a programming language in a database. So if you have a database here, be it a relational one, be it a NoSQL one, be it whatever database, how do you actually persist such type of object? If you have this object in your programming language, it's an example JSON object, for example, can be any sort of object. How do you persist that? How do you get that back? And how do you query the properties of this object? This is, I will go along this topic along my talk. And okay, actually, okay. So actually, how do we do that? And I start with relational databases because that's what probably every one of you has ever used or has used. What the? So I guess every one of you has used relational databases, right? So who has not? Everyone, great. So you know what I'm talking about, and you all know in relational database we have tables. Tables have fixed columns. Every row in a table has the same columns. It's flat, so you don't have hierarchy in the data and so on. So you must conform to that flat table and column schema. Talking about schemas, so relational databases, they have a schema. So if you have a table, you must define what you want to store in that table. You must define these columns. These columns have specific names. These columns have attribute types, or they have data types like this is an integer, this is a string of length, whatever. And you must do that before you can actually save data. If you don't do that, you cannot save anything. If you want to save something different in a table that's not conforming to the schema, then it won't work. And when we want to save our object, which I've shown, we cannot store it like this in a relation database. So I try to get back to this object here. So how do we store that actually? So this is an ID, which is an integer. This is some sort of hierarchy. This is strings, but it's embedded, it's nested. This is a list. How do we store a list? And how do we store this one object in a relation database? And actually, we cannot store it like this. We must first normalize that. We must find a structure that's really fitting that relational model. And what I did, or if I would do it, I would have three database tables for that. So I would have a user object, I would have a user table, I would have a topic table, and I would have a mapping table end to end between them. And this is what I would end up for my one object. I couldn't save millions of these objects, of course, but I have three tables now. So I have a user table, which is mapped. I have a topic table, and they are mapped in between with a mapping table. So now I have three places where I need to store my actual data for this simple sort of object. And once I've defined that structure, I can start saving. Saving in relational database is insert, as you all know. So I insert these records. So this one is the user part. This one is the two topics which the user had, and this one is the actual mapping. So now I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 inserts probably to just store my one object, which is actually a lot of work. And there's actually issues because somewhere in between here, a different connection can come along and insert the same data or can remove data and stuff like that. So I also need to protect this saving by a transaction. So I need to put it or wrap it into something like begin and commit transaction. So it's actually safe and race condition free. And so relation databases provide a lot of things like that. So they provide transactions for me. So I have asset properties for my operations. So if I store an object, I can be sure it's safe completely or not at all. It's durable when it's the commit has finished, and so on. So these are called these asset properties. And I also need that when I want to retrieve my data back. So if I want to select my one object from the database, I need to do three selects probably, or I need to do join which goes to three tables. So I need to fetch data from different places. So I need some sort of transaction around that to protect against concurrency issues. And relational databases are more or less all about that. They provide that. It's fine and it works. But it's a lot of things they need to do in the background. And all what we did so far, so I created a schema, I saved an object, I can select the object back. I do in a relational database with SQL. So SQL is the way to do anything in a relational database. So I can do the full administration with SQL queries, which is fine because I've just one mechanism to query the database and to administer it. It's very, very powerful. And that's how it's done in relational databases. Maybe you don't see it in action, so you don't properly issue an SQL query nowadays, but you have an object relational mapper between your programming language object and your database, which does all the SQL stuff in the background, and all this marshalling. These ORMs are in there in reality, and they take all the tedious work from you, but in the background, they're still doing SQL queries. So SQL is the thing that you deal with in relation databases, which is quite different if you talk about NoSQL databases, which probably means something like there is no SQL, but that's wrong. Actually, NoSQL means nothing specific. So NoSQL is partly understood as not only SQL, but actually nobody knows what NoSQL means. So it's more or less a marketing term. It's not a good name to name a database. Actually, they should have named them non-relational databases probably. But NoSQL is not about not only SQL. It's more or less about being non-relational and some other things. I'll come to that in the next few minutes. So why do we actually have NoSQL databases? So 10 years ago, nobody talked about NoSQL. The term wasn't even coined. So we just had relational databases, and we tried to do everything with relational databases, probably object databases. Nowadays, everybody talks about NoSQL databases. Why are they actually there? So a lot of these new databases, they're quite new. They're probably 3, 4, 5 years old. They've come along. They've emerged in the last few years because of this object relational mapping issue. If I have one programming language object, I need to do tons of SQL queries in the background to put it in database or to get it back, which is kind of tedious. It's also kind of costly, or can be costly in a database, because the database has to do a lot of work. It's more than one storage operation probably. And if I have dynamic data, like I've dynamically structured data, I've no specific schema for my data. I don't know what data I want to save. I just want to save what comes in. I have a problem in a relational database because I can just use a blob and put everything in there, but actually, what schema does it have? None. So if I don't know the schema, or my schema often varies, then the relational database is probably not a good solution. Another few reasons are SQL parsing. So I need to do everything with SQL. SQL parsing may have significant overhead for very primitive operations like give me the data by primary key, store the data by primary key. If everything needs to go through an SQL parser, an SQL query engine with query optimization and so on, this might have significant overhead if I do lots and lots of these queries. Actually, this is kind of, there's a whole class actually of NoSQL databases that fully skip that and try to fix that. And another big problem is nowadays we talk about big data, even if nobody knows what big data means. Big data, actually, we have lots and lots of data that we want to save and that we want to keep in the database. What do we do with that? So if we have a relational database, it might get full at some point, and we need to scale the relational database to more than one instance. Then we have a problem because we have these asset properties. So how do we do our joins if they're distributed? How we do our transactions if they're distributed? We have all these guarantees like we are protected from concurrency issues and so on. And this is kind of hard to achieve if we want to do it in a distributed fashion. if we do it on 10 servers in parallel, it's kind of hard because we need network synchronization, we need locks and so on, and this is actually a scaling problem. And there are specific NoSQL databases which try to fix exactly that, because they don't give you these asset guarantees. They do it differently, so they allow you to scale, but they don't give you these guarantees. So they sacrifice the one for the other. So you have scalability, but you don't have asset and so on. But actually, this is why all these new products came up. And going in now, continuing with that marketing terms, so some of these were named NoSQL or are still named NoSQL, which actually is meant to say these are the not relational database. And nowadays we have a new term, which is NewSQL, which is more or less relational databases with lifted guarantees, I would say, but with scalability. So that I could summarize it like that. But actually, it means not much. It's marketing terms. When I talk about NoSQL, I mean the non-relational databases which occurred in the last few years and which provide alternative solutions to the relational model and to the things that relational databases did. And what's kind of common in this subject, in the NoSQL area, is that the NoSQL databases often sacrifice features that we have in relational databases. So in relational databases, we have transactions, we have joins, we have asset guarantees and all that stuff. And NoSQL databases don't necessarily have them. So they sacrifice some of these features to a different extent, depending on the product. But they give you other features. For instance, some of them give you scalability, or some of them give you higher performance and stuff like that. So you trade in something from the relational database and get another thing for that. And a few example NoSQL databases, probably all of you have heard about some of these. So CouchDB is kind of popular. It's 4 years or 5 years actually old. MongoDB is quite popular NoSQL database. Hadoop got quite popular for big data analysis. RangoDB is the database I work on. Redis is a popular key value store. Then there's the Couchbase server. Then there's databases as a service, so you can actually buy a database online with from Amazon, which is nothing but a distributed online database service. And the same you can do with the Google Cloud database. This is that. And then there's other distributed databases like React and Cassandra. But there's many, many more. This is just examples of them. So these have came up in the last few years. And they have something in common. They're not all completely homogeneous, I would say, but they have some commonalities. So one thing I actually mentioned, or I already mentioned, is most of these databases are non-relational. That means they sacrifice things from the relational world. Most of them are schema-free as well, so you don't have a schema, or you just have a very high-level schema, like this is my database, or this is my table, I would say. But I don't define the internal structures. Most of them are open source. Yeah, that's good. So we like open source, and almost all of them are available as open source products. And some of them are even non-commercial. And they almost all provide simple APIs, so it's actually really easy to use them. So getting started is, in many cases, is just issue a curl request to a database, and then you're ready to go. So you just put your data in, and it's really easy. You don't need to install a lot of stuff and learn a lot of stuff. And some of these NoSQL solutions, like these ones here, not all of them are actually big data solutions. So actually, some of them are meant for low volume data, and some of them are meant for very big volume data volumes. So it's completely different. Some of them are more in this corner here, are designed to allow you to grow to big data sets or big data sizes and to scale a lot. And some of them are not built for that. So they have different, more or less, they have different goals and they have different architectural decisions in them. But the commonality is, yes, they are non-relational, they are schema-free, they are mostly open source, not the ones from Amazon and Google, obviously, but the ones that we can download and install. And they have simple APIs. And non-relational, I mentioned that, so we don't have tables in NoSQL database. So no NoSQL database would name it a table. They would name it a collection or database or whatever, but not table. And there's nothing like a fixed record structure with fixed columns and fixed data types. So that's all gone, more or less. And instead, what you would actually save, instead of tables and records and tables, is you save either aggregates, which you can think of like the object I've shown at the beginning is an aggregate, so it consists of multiple attributes, and they're all put together, and this stuff together is an aggregate. You put this one aggregate into the database as one thing. So you save that, and some of them even are much simpler. You just save a blob. You put a blob in that database, and then you get a blob back, and that's all they do. That's more or less the principle of a key value store. You put any data in, get any data out, the store doesn't care. Here it's a bit more complicated because now we have an and the aggregate has an internal structure which I can use in the database. So I can run queries on parts of that aggregate and so on. But it's different depending on what type we have. And being non-relational, meaning I save either aggregates or blobs, means I don't need complex object relational mapping. So if I have my user object in the programming language, I can put it into the database in one go. I don't need to have ORMs which do a lot of magic work behind the scenes, like this part goes in that table, this part goes in that table, this goes in that. That's not actually necessary because I have one storage operation and I can save my object. So a lot of this object relational mapping can go away now, as we are non-relational. A lot of normalization can go away. So I don't need to normalize my object first because I can store it as it is in the database. So there's no need to really flatten things or to put things into extra tables. That's all gone, more or less. And that also means, because we don't need normalization and all that stuff, we have one place where we can save our data, and we don't actually need joins that often. We don't actually need operations that cross the borders of tables or multiple record operations. It's not actually that common, and they're often sacrificed in many of these databases. So you, in many of these databases, which I will also show, it's not possible to do something like a join. When you work on your data, you do it on one collection at a time, or more or less on one table at a time, but not joining things together. That's even not implemented in many of them. So you work completely differently. And the same is true, as I mentioned, referential integrity. You will never find that in a NoSQL database. Joins, you probably won't find that in many. ACID guarantees, some have that, but many have not. And any guarantees for operations that cross the borders of servers or cross the borders of tables, it's mostly not there, actually, because you work differently. Okay, we have no schemas. That means I'm free to save any sort of data in my database, and I don't need to tell the database beforehand what I want to save. I can just store my data. So in terms of this user object, I would just tell the database, store this. I would not need to define something like, okay, here is an integer, here is a string or something. The database will figure it out or will treat it as a blob. And what also is kind of nice about that is if I save multiple of these objects, they can all have a different structure because there is no authoritative structure for a table or a collection. Everything can be different. So I can save things that are different in the same domain. I can save a user object with an ID column or without an ID column. The database won't care. And this actually means that I don't have a migration issue in the database, so the database doesn't know which schema is actually correct. So there is no such thing as alter table or something like that. That's not there, because the database just allows you to store everything. And what that also means is you need to somehow, in your application, have the version information and figure out the versions and handle them. But it's gone from the database side of database point of view. The database doesn't need to do that, so you won't have a blocking database while an alter table is running, because there is no alter table. And simple interfaces, okay, I mentioned that. That means you often have access to low-level operations, like give me the data by the key, or give me something by whatever, very low-level operations, which don't require a big overhead, and don't require a big statement like select star from blah, blah, blah. It's not actually there. So you have very low level and very specific, very sharp, I'd say, access to the data if you want to. And that also means your queries, what you can do in terms of querying, is often very limited, depending on the database. So it's different, but some databases you can just query by primary key or by secondary key and by nothing else. And in some you can do a bit more, which I will show actually. But a commonality is you wouldn't use SQL as a query language because it can do so much which most of these databases can't do and are not designed to do. So you wouldn't use SQL to do your queries. And one thing about the APIs, again, most of these databases provide a REST API, so you can use HTTP to query data or HTTP to store data. Many of them use JSON as the data format inside, so if you have a web application with which runs with JavaScript, which probably a lot of you have, then you can actually use that and put your JSON data from your front end directly into the database, because the database, if it has JSON and HTTP, then a browser is all you need to just persist your data and to query the database, which is kind of nice. So a lot of these databases are actually web-enabled. You can make them internet-facing if you want to, and that is what Amazon and Google have done with their services. So it's nothing but an internet service with HTTP REST APIs, where you put JSON in and you will get JSON back. That's it. Many of them are distributed, not all, and the target of these distributed NoSQL databases is actually to give you scalability. Some provide more or less, it's a bad term, unlimited scalability. No, it's not unlimited, but some of them allow you to really scale well to a lot of servers with your data. But the problem is, if they allow that, they sacrifice some other features, so you cannot query the whole cluster, of course, and you cannot have transactions in that cluster, of course. So it's actually, you trade something in, you get scalability, you get a lot of features less, but you are allowed to scale now. And when these databases solve scalability issues, they mostly also save failover issues. So you have replicas, which means if one server in your cluster goes down, another can take over because the data is saved partly redundantly and so on. So they solve a lot of this availability and scalability things, but not with asset guarantees, not at the same time. That's not there. Nobody has solved that. If one of you could solve that, you would be millionaires, I think. Yes, so they sacrifice a lot of things. And even in a distributed setup, if you scale to a lot of servers, even those databases, they cannot do it with a consistent view of the data. So if you have a lot of servers, then you will have deviations in your data. So that's what's meant by the replication is often lazy, so it's not synchronous, so it's not blocking, and it's eventually consistent. So at some point, the data will be shipped over to all these servers and you will be in sync. But during that replication is happening, you might be out of sync. So you would see an old version of your data. Actually, that's how it is. And on the market, there are around 100 or more NoSQL databases, so it's hard to keep an overview. I can talk about just some of them, not really many. They're often categorized as being document stores, which provide access to, or they store aggregates and allow you to query these aggregates. Key value stores, which allow you to handle blobs. Then there's this family of wide column stores and graph databases even more. They are more specialized. I won't go them today, so we just ignore these two for today and just look at a few stores and key value stores because there's actually so many. And even if we're in one category, so if we have a document store, let's say we have MongoDB, it's quite different to CouchDB, and even CouchDB is quite different to, let's say, ArangoDB. And the same is true for the key value stores. So they are very, very different. There are single server solutions, there are cluster solutions, and obviously they're much different. So I can just give an overview of what's actually there. In document stores, we save these aggregates. So aggregates are these objects, which I've shown with, bye-bye. They're aggregate data structures and they are self-contained. So an object contains all it needs. It doesn't link to external data, like if I have my user with these topics, the topics are actually in that user object. They are not somewhere external. They're contained in my object. So I actually have an aggregate data structure which I can save at one place and get back with one read operation later, which is kind of nice. I don't need to join tables and stuff like that. So I've my aggregates, they are actually a list of name value pairs. And they have data types, and they can also be nested. So this is this user object from the beginning, which is also an aggregate, and which is also JSON. And I can store it like this in a document database. So actually, you don't need to transform this object anyhow to store that. You just go and store it, because this is an aggregate. And that means if I have an object in my programming language, let's say JavaScript, and if I have a document database, I can just take my object, JSONify it, or make some JSON string representation of that, send it to the server, and the server can take it as it is, because it's actually an aggregate, and I don't need to flatten or normalize my sub-objects, lists, arrays, whatever I have in this object. I don't need to do that. The data store can just save it. And when I get it back, I don't need to reassemble that from three tables or whatever. I can just take my object, get it back, and have it as a JSON representation in my programming language, which means if I have one object in my programming language, I often have one document in the database and not N to M or 1 to 500 or whatever is common. So it's actually a quite good fit. And it's, from my point of view, it's a somewhat better fit than the object to relational things, which kind of explodes if you have complex objects. Document stores, they have a type system. So if we look at this object here, we see this has types. So these are strings, this is an integer, this is a list of strings, and so on. So we now have data types. And data types allow the document store that it can do some basic validation, so you cannot put some actually broken object into that. So you must conform to the type system. And the good thing is this object here, it also has an implicit schema. I nowhere define that there is an ID column or that there must be an ID column or there must be a name, but actually an ID column or an ID attribute is there and a name attribute is there. And when you save such object, the store will figure that out automatically and because it's just JSON, and it later allows you to just query this attribute or this or whatever. So you can access all the individual parts because the document has a schema, but it's implicit. It's not anywhere defined. It's just in that object itself. So you can access all the data in that object later with queries. So you have a lot of query power because you can access all the attributes and all the sub-attributes and the list elements and so on. And I will look at CouchDB, MongoDB, and ArangoDB and how they do that, because they are quite different, even if they are all document stores. So let's start with CouchDB. It's a popular document store. It uses JSON internally, so you can store JSON. And if you have a JSON frontend, then it's a good fit because you have JSON in the frontend and in the backend. And if you organize your data, you don't have tables. You have something like a database. So everything that is similar, like users, go into a database which would be named users. So you would save all your user objects in your user database in CouchDB. It has a REST API, so all you do is send HTTP to the database and get HTTP back. And inside there would be JSON. And that's actually it. So you can use curl to communicate or you use your browser, whatever. So it's fully usable with a web browser. And to store something, we first need to tell the database, okay, we have something like a user database, and we create it like this. So we just issue a put request, which will make the database server create that database. And if we want to store data, we have a post request. So we put the JSON stuff in there, send it to the database, and the database will accept it. You can do that from your application server. You can also do it from a JavaScript frontend if you want to, because it's just HTTP. And that's the way how you store your data in there. And if you want to get it back, you issue a GET request, an HTTP GET. That's all you have. And this is the unique ID of that document or of that object that we saved. So we are in the user database, and we have the object with the ID 1234. And that's how you get it back. And everything else is more complex there. So you cannot just issue an SQL query to the database, and the database will figure out what you meant. No, you access your data by the primary key. That's more or less what you can do. If you want to do anything else in CouchDB, you need to write some view. A view is CouchDB's way of running arbitrary queries on your data. And views are actually populated by MapReduce. So you have a toolkit there. So you have JavaScript and a MapReduce framework inside CouchDB. And if you want to do any sort of querying, you need to write MapReduce functions in CouchDB, which are executed in the database. And whenever you query this view later, the view gets populated, so all the data gets selected, is stored in that view, and you can query that later because the view is also persistent. So the view data is actually a persistent secondary index in CouchDB. And MapReduce is not only usable in CouchDB, so it's a general framework. So Google made it popular about 10 years ago, probably. So they came up with MapReduce as some sort of, hey, this is distributed, scales, wow, great, blah. And so everybody wants to do MapReduce. And MapReduce is actually, it's very simple. It's just an approach to do to apply functions on data in a partly distributed way. Or if you want to, you can do it in a distributed way. So everything you do, every document that you have, you run through a map function. So you have a function that you define in every document, every user document will go through the map function. And in that map function, you can filter out the data that you don't want. So you can do it, you can use it so you can do it for filtering, but you can also rewrite the document and write out something else. And if you actually, map is one thing, if you're happy with that, that is your result, but you can also pass that result of the map function to a reduce function, which is optional. And if you do it, then you also have aggregation capabilities. I'll make some examples. So this is how select star from user where music in topics would look like in CouchDB. So you would filter, you would have a map function, every document goes in there. We look for, if one of the topics is music, we just emit something, which is the document itself, so we get some result like this here back. So actually, what you do. And this is what you would get if you run that view, if you query that view via HTTP. So this is the result list. And something else, you can also do this popular example, which just counts topics, more or less. So if we have different topics, like we have skating, we have music and whatever, we want to know how many times do we have skating, how many times do we have music and so on. This would work like this. So again, we have a map function. We go over all the topics in each document. We just emit the topic name and a one. So for the first user which had skating and music, we just emit skating one, music one. Next user, skating one, running one or whatever, I don't know, which is just a very long list of topics and a one. And actually what MapReduce does is sort that list by that first value. So we now have a list that we can group on. So if it's sorted, we can group on, and here we instantly see skating we have two times, music we have once, and so on. So actually this is what is later done in reduce. So in reduce, you get all the, you get this key, or more or less you get these values on the left and the values on the right, and you can just do something like sum them. So here you would get skating and two values, which you just sum up, which is two. And that's actually what you can do in reduce. So it's actually very simple. In the normal case, you would just count your values, which would provide you with that. And for music, it would be one. And that's how select topic, comma, count star from user where blah, group by topic would work in MapReduce. And it's not limited to CouchDB. So it's present in MongoDB, it's present in React, it's present in many other stores. It's a general approach, and it's kind of powerful, but it's programming. It's not writing an SQL query. It's something very different. So it's actually programming to get your data, and you have to do it a lot if you want to do a lot of different queries. And you need to like that. It's not the best thing for everyone, I think. Okay, thinking about MongoDB, which is another document store, it's not JSON, it's not using JSON, it's using BSON, which is something like, it looks like JSON if you print it, but it's internal, it's binary, and it can do a bit more. It has databases with collections, which is the equivalent to tables in the relational world, and it has its own client. And if you want to save data, you can do it like this. So you have a DB object, you have your user table, or collection, sorry, and you just save your object. So same thing. You take your object and store it, and that's it, to save this object in MongoDB, which is kind of easy to do because this is also JavaScript. And if you have a JavaScript front end and do a lot of JavaScript stuff, then this is just JavaScript that you can use there and to store your object. To get it back, you have things like find command. You can sort search by any sort of criteria, like, okay, I want to find by unique ID, which is obviously using the primary index. You can also do more complex things like name.first equals something, which you cannot really do in SQL because in SQL you don't have nested attributes like name.first, but you can do that in document database. You can also, this is how complex queries look like in MongoDB. They all have these dollar signs. They are named query operators without these dollars. So this is select star from user where name.first equals foo or skating in topics, which is kind of, yeah, you have to like that. If you have a complex query and you have a lot of conditions that you combine, then it gets messy because, of course, you can put ands in something like and in or nest them more, and gets really, really messy. And if you want to write that on the command line, you're more or less doomed. But that's how it works and what you can do. Obviously, if you want to use that from a programming language, you would use a driver, which has a nice method in your programming language of choice. This is just the command line solution. And you can combine this find query with count, limit, sort, skip, whatever, to make it more conforming to what you actually want. You can create secondary indexes so your find queries execute faster. You have some special functions for aggregation, but whatever you do there, you can not join data from multiple collections. So you're always down to the one collection you actually run your find query in. You cannot do a join or cross, whatever, you cannot do that. And actually, if your data fits into that schema, then that's fine. If you want to do something more and join data together, you cannot do that with MongoDB. And you can also not do that in CouchDB. Another one, RangoDB, it's a document store. It's also using JSON. It's also using HTTP, so the same as CouchDB. In CouchDB, we had database. Here we have collection, but that's just a different name. It looks a bit like MongoDB, so you just store your data. It has a different, the internal ID has its name key, but not ID, but actually it's the same. You just save JSON in your database. And you do it like this. There's no need for normalization. Just put your object in there and database is happy. If you want to get it back, you query it with that unique ID of that document and then you get your user document back. This looks a bit like the find stuff from MongoDB, so it's actually, it's a bit actually the same than in the others. But what's on top of there? It has its own query language. So there is no SQL in NoSQL, obviously, but there's AQL in a RangoDB, which is a query language of its own to do things like complex queries. So you want to do things like projections, filtering, aggregation. You want probably to do joins and stuff like that. Then there is this query language in a RangoDB which can do that. And it will automatically use indexes if they are available on filter conditions or join criteria and stuff like that. And the best thing is it's embedding JSON, so you can write JSON documents in that query language. So this one here is actually using JSON. And this is an AQL query that you can run in RangoDB to do some more complex things, like I want to get things by primary key. Okay, everybody can do that. But this one here will give you something more. So it's actually filtering on users that have skating in the topic list, but have also more than or at least three topics, which is kind of a query that it's harder to achieve with other databases. Not with the relational one, but in NoSQL, it's kind of hard to achieve. But here you have a full-blown query language which can do that. And you can also do some sort of aggregation, like how many topics did the user have? You can all have this here in this query language. So you can actually do a lot of things if you pick the database which can do it. And here's another query which is also using aggregation. It's collect is the word for group by, actually, or it's the replacement for group by. You go over all these user documents, you enumerate the topics, and then you simply count for each topic how often did you have them. So it's actually something like a count star, group by, whatever in SQL. But it's all achievable. Provided that you have a database that can do it. And for instance, in CouchDB, you would do it with MapReduce. In MongoDB, it would be something else. So you'd write your aggregation query. In RangoDB, you'd use AQL to do that. So there are ways to do more complex queries. This is actually a simple example. You can do much more complex things, obviously. Okay, these were document stores, which allow you a lot of querying or query possibilities, so you have all your aggregates in there. You can query on any attribute, be it a string, be it an integer, be it a list. You can query on the individual list elements. That's all nice and fine. But there's another class of NoSQL database which don't allow you to do that. They are much simpler. They are key value stores. So key value stores have a different sweet spot. They are not there for maximum query, I'd say query power or query capabilities. They are more or less there for a different thing that is actually performance. And this is because in a key value store, you map a value to a unique key. So you have a key and you store a value for that key. And this is how it would actually look. This is your key. You have your user, 1, 2, 3, 4. Whatever you want to put behind that key, you just tell the store and the store will save it. And to get it back, you just supply the key and you get your data back, whatever it is. And the good thing about that is a key value store will not care what you save. So it will just take your key and the value, and whatever the value is, will put it in. And it will not validate. It doesn't know anything about the value. It doesn't know if it has a schema, if it's JSON, if it's a binary. It doesn't know. So it just saves it and treats it as a blob, which means it's very efficient. So it can treat or can handle the data very efficiently. And this is kind of nice because actually key value stores allow, I would say, an order of magnitude more throughput than the other database, because there is no such thing as SQL parsing or validation and stuff like that. So you just have key and value, put it in, get it back. It cannot get much simpler. So they're very efficient and they allow some very simple operations like set the value or store the value, get the value back, delete the value, replace the value, increase the value behind some key or decrease the value. And these are actually hacks. If anybody of you has used Memcache, so Memcached is exactly the same, and more or less every key value store has these operations. For increase and decrease, the store will look at the value and see, oh, it looks like a number, then I can increase it. But actually, it doesn't know if it's a number, so it just treats it as a number for the operation. And there are some other features, like you can enumerate keys in the key value store. Some allow you that, Memcached, it doesn't allow you that, so you don't actually know what you have in there. Some other stores allow that. So this is some kind of feature that you might have. A few examples about Redis. So Redis is a key value store, which is quite popular because it's also very fast. I think the most popular one that everybody of you has ever or probably heard of is Memcached, because it's out there for so long, and many, many other key value stores are actually have been based on Memcached initially. So many of these key value stores that we have now are further developments of Memcached. Redis is not, but it's kind of similar. If you store your data, just supply the key, supply the value, okay, all right, to get it back. Supply the key, get the value back, that's fine. If you want to see what kind of user elements do I have or what kind of user keys do I have in my database, you can issue something like this. This is a key prefix query, and this will enumerate all the keys. So you see, okay, I have a user with an ID 1, 2, 3, 4. I have a user with an ID 2, 3, whatever, I don't know. So this is kind of powerful because you cannot do much with the key value store. So you can get your data by key, and actually, that's it. This kind of key enumeration is thus kind of powerful, and it allows you more kinds of queries. So you cannot do more with the key value store, except Redis gives you some extra commands to work on data structures. So it has special commands to work with hashes, lists, sets. It also has functionality which kind of extends what you can do with the key value store. And these commands allow you to use Redis for something more than just simple key value things. For instance, if we have our users, we can do something like this. So this is the Redis command for add something on the right to the set. So we create a set, topic skating, give it a value 1, 2, 3, 4. We add 2, 3, 4, 5 to the set. We create a set topic music, put this in there. We have a set topic running and so on. So we have three sets with values in them. And after that, we can just query, okay, which members in the set skating did we have? So these were our user IDs, for instance. We can just get back. So we have something like, which users have which topics. We can model that in Redis, but actually we have to store the data accordingly to that. So we cannot just use our blob and use that, so we have to store the data separately. So it fits actually the commands that Redis offers us. We can also do something more like which users have the topics skating and music. Then we take two sets and take the intersection of them, which will give us just for instance, this one user ID. So we can do some sort of queries or seemingly complex queries with Redis, even if it's implemented so simple. So we can do more than it seems, but your data needs to fit that structure or needs to fit that command. If it doesn't fit, you cannot use that, or you have to make your data fit into that structure. And okay, I'll skip that. It's all in the slides later on. And skip that too. Okay, other key value stores apart from Redis, okay, many of them are based on Memcached, so they still have a lot of the Memcached guts, like the protocol. Several others provide an HTTP API, so you don't have a binary protocol, but just speak HTTP with the key value store. And some of these stores allow you to maintain secondary indexes on your data. So you can do more queries, not only by key, but also by secondary key. But because the key value store doesn't know what to put into the secondary index, you need to supply the index values yourself. So when you store a value, you need to supply the key, the value, and the values for the secondary index yourself. And then you can do equality and range queries on that. And that's about what you can do with the key value store. Some of them also give you MapReduce capabilities. That means you can just write arbitrary queries, which are normally expressed in JavaScript, and the store will happily run that on all your data. Okay, to sum that up, NoSQL databases actually, they're very different from relational databases. First of all, I don't like the term NoSQL that much, so I would name them non-relational, and because NoSQL databases, none of them follow the relational model. So they're quite different from them. You don't have fixed tables with fixed columns with data types and stuff like that. No, instead you save aggregates or just blobs, and all the features that we're used to from relational databases, like ACID, transactions, joins, stuff like that, SQL, they are left away in NoSQL database intentionally, or most of them are left away. And this is done on purpose, so it's not something like an accident. So they are left away because they cause problems when you want to be fast or when you want to scale or whatever. So they are intentionally left away in many of these NoSQL databases. So SQL is actually not there. And if it's there, then it's just a front end to something, to a back end that really works differently. We have different categories. I today spoke a bit about document stores and key value stores, but just very briefly. And I showed three document stores, but there's probably 15 or 20 of them actually on the market. So go out and check them out. They're all different. So the NoSQL world is not very standardized. Like in the relation world, you have a database and all databases speak SQL. If your relation database doesn't support SQL, you're out. In NoSQL, it's very different. So every database is different. In some, you use HTTP, in some, you use a binary protocol, in some, you put JSON in, some, you put something else in. Some have these APIs, some have those APIs. So it's really not that standardized. There are very many different solutions around. And let's see if it stays like this for the next few years. I don't know. But at the moment, it's very heterogeneous. In a key value store, you cannot do much, but the purpose of a key value store is not to give you the best query possibilities or query expressibility. The purpose of a key value store is to be fast as possible, and to be, for the distributed ones, to be scalable and fail safe. And document stores, they allow you to express more complex queries, so you can access all the parts of the things that you save and do very complex operations on them. But they are not designed to be as lightning fast as probably key value stores. So they have a different purpose. And I didn't even talk about graph databases and stuff like that. In terms of getting used, each NoSQL database is, most of them are open source, as I mentioned. They're actually easy to learn. Most of them have an HTTP API with JSON inside. It's very easy to learn. If you speak HTTP, which probably all of you do, you can just use them. It's really simple to do. Another good thing about the HTTP enabledness is that you can use a browser for many of these databases and administer them. And you can also use the database more or less as make it an internet-facing database if you want to. So you have a browser somewhere that can directly speak to the database. You have a handheld or mobile somewhere that can directly speak to the database, because everyone speaks HTTP nowadays. Even the simplest mobile clients can do. And as I mentioned, there is no such thing as a standard. So if you find a NoSQL database, look at it. It might be completely different from what I told you. And the next NoSQL database you found might be completely different from the first one that you found. So there's really deviations in them. So there's nothing like they all follow the same relational model or whatever. They're just different things. And you should have a close look at the database. If you pick one, have a close look and check if it does what you want to do with it, because otherwise you might be dissatisfied. There are a lot of good solutions, but they don't. You need to find the right ones. So they're not all general purpose, I'd say. So if you have something like an Oracle database, it can do a lot of things. And in NoSQL, if you have a key value store, it cannot do a lot of things. It can do one thing very good, but you cannot do everything with it. And that's how it is. They're partly not general purpose products. They're specialized products, but there is a trend to go more mainstream with them. Last word, there is one interesting attempt. So we've seen that if we query a key value store, if we query a document store, if we query a relational database, we have different approaches. We have SQL for relational. We have in MongoDB, we have this kind of syntax. In ArangoDB, we have this kind of syntax. In CouchDB, we write views and stuff like that. So it's all different. There's one attempt, which is named JSONIC, to have one global query language for all databases in the background and just have more or less this query language. It's abstract, so it's not dedicated to one database. So you have just one general query language, and you have different backend adapters for that. So there's some transformation from that common language to the individual database. So you have a MySQL backend, you have a Couchbase backend, and you have some MongoDB backend for that. But you can use the same queries. I'm not saying that it's efficient for all databases, but it's at least an attempt to standardize that, because there are no standards in NoSQL right now. And it's something to look at for the future, because maybe it's successful, so sounds interesting at least. Okay, all right, I'm through. You've done it. If you have any questions, now to raise hands, right? Okay, the question was if we have sets in Redis and save data in the sets, can we reference from the one data to the other? No, you can't. So they're completely separate and you need to store redundantly if you want to use that. Or you move that data out from the first one and just store it in the set. But they're not anyhow interrelated. Do you have a question?
No.
Anyone else? Free hugs. Yes. Okay, so the question was, what kind of state of data would you get when while a query is running? Let's say a long-running aggregation query is running and you have changes in the data in the meantime. That's a good question. So in the databases go a different way. So in an SQL database, you would have a transaction which would protect you from the changes. Couchbase, for instance, if you query multiple things together, you would just get any version. So you would get a mixed result, more or less, something which could be old or something which could be new, and it's all the last one that is there just wins. MongoDB, actually, you have control over that. So you can make your query blocking, or you can make your query yield, so it gets interrupted and you get other things can run in the meantime. So you have control over that. In ArangoDB, it's at the moment it's blocking, so while your query runs, it's you get a consistent view of the data. So you wouldn't do it for 60-minute queries or so, but for things like millisecond queries, then it shouldn't be a problem. Yeah. Yes, it's controllable, but it's nothing like you would get a fully consistent view of your of your data. That's, yeah, it's distributed, and that's not the purpose. So the purpose is to scale, and they sacrifice consistency. That's a design decision, which is fine, but yeah. Yes. Yeah, it's different. So MongoDB, actually, they've gained a lot of money from investors. Sorry. I forgot to repeat the question, so I'll repeat the question first. So how stable or different or mature are the interfaces from the different programming language to the database I've mentioned? It's different. MongoDB actually has raised a lot of venture capital. They have a lot of people that write their drivers and stuff like that. So they're getting better and better. CouchDB, actually, I think there are several drivers contributed by the public domain, but they are partly different, so they're not the same for all languages. And for our database, I can say that we have community contributions, and the drivers there are different. So if you have a Ruby driver, it's different than the Java driver or the PHP driver, which is partly okay from my point of view, because you have, in different languages, you follow different paradigms. So in Ruby, you would use a DSL or whatever, which you wouldn't do in PHP or stuff like that. So there are natural differences, but there are also differences because they are contributed by different persons. Yes. Yes. So the question was, can I add data to an already existing object? Yes, you can. In a key value store, you just replace what's behind that key. So if you already have data for the key, you just throw it away and store the new object, the complete object, obviously. So you cannot do something like, I add something to that, but you would replace it entirely. In a document store, you can, it's different. You can partly update with, so you can run an update query on just one attribute. That's possible. And for CouchDB, RangoDB, and probably some other document database, you would just supply the entire new object. And what comes to my mind is we also support, or in the RangoDB, we also support partial updates. So you can just supply the updated values for the object, and we'll just merge them in. But yes, but they are different. As in NoSQL, it's always the case. Yeah. Yes. Yes, depending on the database. So MongoDB has... So I always forgot repeating the questions. The question was, are there any special functions to work with geographical data, like accessing latitude, longitude, and vicinity, and stuff like that? Yes, partly. MongoDB has functions for that. RangoDB has functions for that. I'm not aware of any CouchDB functions or in key value stores. That's kind of uncommon. But yes, some have that, yes. Yes. The what? Not really. So the question was if I used Python and the ZOPE object database. So yeah. AQL. Okay. So he was telling me something about the ZODB object database, which is probably something built in Python. I'm not an expert. I just learned that. And he was asking me about that, if it's if I have any experience with that. No, I don't have, but I will talk to you after that. So, all right. I think we are forced to end. For any further questions, I'll be happy to answer them. So I'll be around here for the next few minutes. Thanks.